Hello, listeners. This is Greg, your Iron Podcaster. Just a brief trigger warning. Today's content is going to involve a discussion of rape in media and its presence in Tiger's Eye. Much of what we discuss is in the realm of theory and not the specifics, but I cannot guarantee what form a trigger will take for everyone, so I put in this prior warning. The discussion does take up most of the content, but for those who might want to avoid it, the discussion begins at 24 minutes and 24 seconds, and ends at 1 hour, 5 minutes, and 55 seconds. With that said, welcome back to another trip through the wind door.
Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of Through the Wind Door with your friends Greg and Toby. Today, we're going to be covering chapters 16 through 20, or it's actually a little more complicated than that, because for the first time, we're coming up against one of those unusual differences between the written novel and the audio drama.
Brown has a different face in the written book, and in the audio one, there's a very different face.
You won't understand that unless I put in some of the before podcast conversation, but if I do, I assure you, it'll be very funny. The short answer is that we talked a lot about the new Spider-Man Miles Morales game in our pre-podcast recording, and while there may be enjoyable content there, it is long and meandering, and it feels like a long way to go off topic even for outtakes. So I will just leave a link in the show notes explaining the joke, if anyone cares.
This won't make the cut. I know it. Sorry, Greg. Please go on. I just couldn't resist.
Yeah, we know that about you. In fact, in the most recent episode that I'm editing right now, I literally put it in aside being, don't lie to the audience, Toby. We all know that you're going to go for the easy joke if it's available.
I have no restraint. You know this. I feel like it's important for me to acknowledge it.
It's okay. We still love you. It's just part of our brand. This above all, to our own selves be true. This is us.
Yep.
So for clarification, for those that are familiar with the novel and are following along with it in that manner, the subjects and events that we are covering will be chapters 16 through 20. And if you are instead listening to the audio drama, or just the audio drama is the thing that you are more familiar with, then the sequence of events will actually cover chapters 16 through 21. 21 occupying the same place in the written version, Tales from the Stalwart Whale, whereas the thing that was originally chapter 18 in the book expands to chapters 18 and 19 in the audio drama. I don't necessarily know why this is, but based on some of the things that Alex has said about maximum lengths of audio files that he could upload to Bandcamp when he was talking about some of the stuff that he went through with the audio drama for Uncivil Outlaw, it may well be that lengthwise it just made more sense to divide that one chapter up into two separate files. Either way, this is just a bookkeeping thing so that, you know, for those of you that are following along for the first time, or, you know, even for just the people that are reading these specific chapters as you go to hear us talk about the events that are relevant to those chapters, just so you don't get confused. The following episode after this, or rather the episodes where we finally start covering the final chapters of Tiger's Eye, there will be another shift where what would normally be chapters 22 through 25 will actually go from chapters 22 through 27 of the audio drama.
Well, that one should be less confusing because whichever version we're asking you to go through, we're asking you to just finish the rest of the story for the next episode. So
yeah,
this one's a bit more confusing in that it is in the middle.
Yeah, fair enough. But I obviously want to put these notifications everywhere just so people are prepared. Mm-hmm. I mention it briefly as being, oh, this is the thing that we're going to have to deal with later on in the most recent episode. And I'll highlight it briefly in the episode just prior. And I'm telling you right now as being a part of this recording, just so all bases are covered and it'll be like be in the show notes as well. Anyway, making a lot of noise in order to cover for the fact that this first chapter is a bit of a doozy in terms of the one major event that sort of overshadows everything else. Like, there is more in chapter 16 to talk about, and ironically, the event takes up such a small amount of space. Hmm. That,
and there are horrible things that are happening besides this, so our emphasis of this moment is not to say that this is the only moment that is horrible. It is more to just acknowledge the nature of it, that it dominates the sort of, it does preoccupy the reader.
I guess it's more accurate to say that it preoccupied us. Different readers are going to have different thresholds. But on top of that, as we'll get into, it's one thing to have something as button-pushing as rape in a piece of media that we love. It's another thing to have to talk about it, and by extension, all the baggage that comes with the use of rape in media. As we're getting into talking about it, with some of the additional framing narrative, as I was rereading and re-listening and ended up looking at some additional material to sort of give myself additional context to what was going on. For any of you that ever saw the miniseries Roots, where famed actor LeVar Burton played the titular character of Kunta Kinte, some of this stuff is going to be fairly familiar to you in terms of the events that take place both on deck of the boat and beneath the boat. Because in that particular series, which begins with Kunta Kinte being captured along with several of his tribesmen and several men and women from other tribes, it includes scenes like the slaves being exercised on the top of the boat and the image of one of the sailors manning the golden cannon. The golden cannon makes its presence known here as well, especially as violence breaks out on deck. The cannon is used in both Roots and in Tiger's Eye as a tool of suppression. It's just in terms of like how successful they are as a result is turns out a little bit differently here. It's using similar imagery, as well as the idea in Roots that Kunta Kinte is sort of spearheading trying to communicate by finding those that knows the individual languages of different tribes and passing it around so that they can all have more of a shared language and be able to organized together and everything like that. It's been a very long time since I've seen it. Along with other things, the show notes will include a clip where the golden cannon is used in Roots, as well as an interview with LeVar Burton that I found fascinating, where he has asked his opinion about the Roots remake that they did a few years ago. It's derivative, but it's exceptionally effective in how this stuff is used to inform and build on the story of Tiger's Eye.
The item of a golden cannon used, especially in Tiger's Eye, I don't know the exact positioning in Roots, but in Tiger's Eye, it seems to be something that's been positioned above the cats as they work on deck. Though, do correct me if I'm getting that detail wrong.
The positioning of the cannon is actually not mentioned in the text, merely that two lions were atop the cannon itself. In Roots, the cannon is only slightly elevated, though while I will admit, I don't have a good understanding of how big the stalwart whale is. When I first pictured it, I imagined a large ship with cannons like we see so often in Master and Commander or Pirates of the Caribbean. The ship in Roots looks a lot different, and is smaller overall. Which makes sense. It's a cargo ship, not a ship made to do battle.
As this unknown object to Hrau and the other tigers, this strange golden cannon or device, gold as a metal is not really going to be something that they will have become familiar with, because it's something that's prized a lot more or has been implemented into European society and civilization, so it has that. And it also, the way that it's used to hit them with a mighty blow from above, feels very much like a thunderbolt of Zeus. Like, it is an Olympian vengeful act that feels like it might be something that was intentionally thought of by the people who designed this. I don't know if the World of Cats has a Greek pantheon. That's something else we can think about in future episodes, I'm sure. But my point is, the symbology of the item is implemented with enough careful thinking things out that I don't think it's just a case of lifting it and putting it in. I think it has consideration behind it.
Just a quick correction here. The cannon was very likely not made of gold. That would be a lot of wealth gone to waste for something that was supposed to be functional, not decorative. And gold is actually very poor for something that is meant to be structural, never mind used to fire something explosively. It was probably made of bronze or some other metal alloy and polished to a fine sheen. But as Toby says, the color is the symbol of the Lions of Albion, and not the metal itself. It wasn't one of the subjects that I had originally on the list, but one of the things that I did have in the back of my mind, and maybe we'll get more into this when we do our final wrap-up on Tiger's Eye, is that based on the mythology of the cats of Rama, the cats of the New World, so to speak, they understand that there are various different kinds of great cat, because all these different kinds of cat are integrated into their
mythology.
Their mythology, yeah, exactly. And
they know what a lion is. They don't go, "What is this cat I've never seen before?"
Yeah, exactly. And that makes me wonder more about if there are lion tribes somewhere else on the continent, and that they're familiar with them as a race, not just from mythology, but from personal experience. And it just so happens that just because these cats are lions and they come from a seemingly more civilized society doesn't mean that they are not considered as other, as, say, the white colonists might have seemed to the peoples of the Caribbean or the peoples of South America or the First Nations tribes of North America in terms of manner and skin tone and all that sort of thing. In regards to the relationships between peoples that looked so very different from each other, there has been portrayals that because of the, say, the difference in skin color, that associate them with either gods or with darker supernatural forces that therefore should be feared, at just based on how they look alone, not necessarily even based on what they do, and, you know, in many cases what the white colonists did to Aboriginal races were pretty monstrous. So
yeah, not great. Generally agreed, not great, and those who disagree are pretty disagreeable. Something that occurs to me is that if there were lion tribes in the New World, which is, it does pose this interesting question, is do the lions of Albion call their world Rama? We don't know, but if these lions came over to the New World and they did actually find a tribe of lions, I think whether that tribe of lions exists or not, that it makes sense that Hrau has not seen any lions who have been captured and held captive in this slave trade, because if they're making this argument that the slavery is the natural way of things because these cats are just not as civilized or intelligent as lions are, it kind of would be quite a easy counter argument to say, well, why are we doing it to the lions as well? They look like us.
Share the same felinity.
Yeah, they share the same felinity. And I think that that could be an intriguing plot point going forward. In whichever way it goes, whether lions do exist in Rama, and that will be like a question that I think future stories will tackle, or if they don't, then just the fact that the mythology of Rama means that these tribes are still aware of lions, even if they have not met any for a very long time. That's something to take into consideration.
We honestly don't even know if, for all that they are different tribes of great cats, whether they share a similar mythology. The only one we know for certain comes from the mouths of Haka and Hrau themselves, in terms of how they tell the stories or how they interact with the world. And in that particular case, they have the Fire Lion being the head of the pantheon, and the tiger in that particular hierarchy is referred to as the Tiger of Light and is inferred to be the moon goddess, basically. But all of that is still just Durga tribe. We don't know if the leopards or the panthers or the cheetahs or any of them, if they have a similar mythology, if they have a slightly variant mythology, and maybe in that one, a different cat takes a different place of prominence in their mythology. And we have really less than no idea of what religion, if any at all, that the Lions of Albion have. This may very likely be something that we don't actually get any insight into until Panther Soul finally comes around, because we don't even yet know exactly where that story is taking place. It may be in Rama, or it may be somewhere else. Excuse me. Because we have to specify now, it may be taking place in the New World equivalent of Rama, or it could be taking place someplace completely else. It's nothing even saying that the New World continent has to bear any resemblance to
the Americas
at all. Exactly. There's obviously a direct correlation between the Lions of Albion and the British Empire. As previously mentioned, Albion is an ancient term for the English. I don't know what the exact origin of it from. It's just something that I looked up along the way. And it's been used before in other fictional pieces of media, more specifically Girl Genius, in order to refer to the British Isles and the culture and government that controls it. So,
also, the Fable series calls its kingdom that, and it's very sort of much a British fantasy kingdom, which is brought into sharp relief due to the presence of British celebrities and that sort of thing, which make you go, okay, so this is fantasy UK, got it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. I had played, I think it was Fables 2 or something like that, but that was not one of the ones that I put a lot of personal time into, so I'd forgotten about that connection as well. So anyway, we may get into talking some more about those things when we do our wrap up, as I said. Well, I'm still in the process of trying to figure out what aspects I want to focus on. We may, instead of looking at it from some of the previous perspectives, because obviously Gothic doesn't really fit into this kind of story, I'm pondering the possibility of looking
at... That sounds like a challenge.
Don't tell me what to do.
No. I will not try to force Tiger's Eye into a box, because as has long been established, I would open many boxes. So.
Going right back to the box metaphor.
Yeah. The box.
Obviously, by this point, Toby and I have already decided that we've talked a lot about the story itself and its many facets, and while we could try to see what genre the story fits into, or what archetypes it uses in terms of, say, Joseph Campbell or some other format, what we're actually going to do is something different than we have before. I'm going to put on the psychology hat, and Toby and I are going to be interrogating each other on why this story means as much to us as it does, what resonates on a personal level. I've got some stuff that I've been kneading over for months now, and I think I've got a handle on what it was that was bugging me ever since that first episode covering chapters 11 through 15. I hope it'll be interesting for you to listen to, and that Toby and I might end up growing a little bit along the way.
We would be remiss if we did not bring up the comparison to the hero's journey, but one reason why I'm perhaps keen to not sort of go too much into that is that I think that is ground that it was already pretty well covered by Alex himself on the School of Movies Hero's Journey episode, where they look into how the hero's journey applies to a whole bunch of different stories, but one of them is Tiger's Eye, and he even mentions the fact that the ship is literally called the whale. It is, they are literally in the belly of the whale. So
in that case, if we can get access to that
that's some good homework.
Yeah, exactly. Based on our goals for the final episode, I think what we will do is post a link to the Hero's Journey podcast with a timestamp so that people can listen to the deconstruction of Tiger's Eye from the perspective of that narrative format. But at this point, we've been delaying the big conversation even further. So let's get into it. Listeners, for those of you that are not aware, although some of these conversations happened a little bit on Discord, I went to Alex in order to talk about the violation of Horau in Chapter 16 and was curious what was talked about in regards to it in the original Behind the White Scarves roundtables. And so Alex was kind enough to remove a portion of that conversation for Toby and I to appreciate as we collected our thoughts and tried to figure out what we were going to be saying about it, how we felt about it, and all that sort of thing. It ended up including a whole bunch of other smaller parts, which add to the wider tapestry of what we understood about the creation of this story. Alex is basically going out of his way to try and not include a whole lot of this means this, leaving Toby and I to figure out our own feelings on that without feeling like Alex or anybody else is coming from on high saying there can be no other interpretation to this.
But yeah, don't do our job for us, Alex. We want to tell you how much we enjoy our books for ourselves. Thank you very much.
As it turns out, this one section of the roundtable included a whole lot more than originally expected. It's got multiple aspects to it that I mine little bits and pieces for the episodes that I'm editing right now, as well as just, you know, provoking thought in other areas. And even the section that included the outtakes, which both of us might not have heard before, was just a treasure trove of stuff that I will be used as partial content as we continue to put out new episodes and edit old ones. So that ended up being not just a, okay, we need to figure out how to talk about this very serious subject. It's contributed in many ways to other parts of the story and just been a fun time in general to appreciate. So yes, we're thankful for that.
With that out of the way, as much as I have enjoyed us beating around the bush and trying to just do everything in our power to not confront it, I think that the time has come for us to talk about... the time's come to talk about the violation of Rao.
So we keep on using that word. Whenever you talk about rape in any kind of story, it can be very important to use the word, even if the word itself makes the reader or the audience or whoever it is uncomfortable. And it's clear just from all of you listeners listening to us right now that even we are not above trying to avoid talk about it or trying to use other language to describe what actually happened. And that's, to put it bluntly, that's rape culture right there, is the fact that we don't like addressing this fairly horrific aspect of what people can do to each other. And so
it's a difficult thing to look into its eye.
Yeah, exactly. And this is part of the reason why, and Toby and I are more or less in agreement on this. It's one of the reasons why, by and large, we don't necessarily want to see rape at all in our fiction. And when I say that, I want to be clear. This is not us pointing fingers at anyone that does include rape as a story element. We're going to end up talking a lot about why we feel this way, and much of it is more about the history of its use in fiction. So, bear with us. Like, it's not that we're asking authors to censor themselves or to paint us only pretty pictures or anything like that. But,
or to obscure a dark part of life that is nevertheless a part of the real world that is something that is worth, as we said a moment ago, looking into its eye. But
well, so here's the thing. The problem is that a lot of storytellers use rape to certain ends that make us feel like, why did you even do this? It feels like it's making the situation overall worse by having it as, it's an opportunity to victimize women. It's an opportunity supposedly to differentiate, oh, this person isn't just bad, they're really bad. They've crossed some sort of moral threshold by being willing to invoke, or rather to visit, this kind of violence on a woman. And it's almost always a woman. It's a completely different, cringeworthy, difficult moment if it is in fact men perpetrating it on men, or, you know, the one that is so verboten that it almost never comes up in media, if it's visited by a woman on a man or another woman. That's just the erasure of that in media, never mind, you know, the fact that people try to claim that it doesn't happen in the real world either is bad enough. Yeah.
No, that action really does create exactly that effect, is that by having it be depicted as just this, and as we say, it's this catch-22. We don't want rape to be freely, like, sort of applied, like, without thought, and for it to become a widespread inclusion in any sort of mature drama. But at the same time, the fact that when it is included, it is predominantly this one form of it, it does make it feel like you are saying that this is the only way it exists, and it blinds people to the fact that you have to be aware that this act is, it has so many different forms that it can be, and there's the victims from any background do exist and have had their stories to tell.
And in the meantime, when rape is included in a story, usually by lazy writers, it almost always tends to be male writers, which unfortunately automatically puts Alex on the back foot. We don't necessarily want to put him there either, but that's still part of the framing narrative that we have to consider. For example, one of the quote-unquote best occasions of having rape being a part of a plot and part of the character development of a main character happened in one of the urban fantasy series that I enjoy reading. Some people may be aware of Patricia Briggs. She puts out, she's put out a lot of different kinds of fiction out there, but the one that has been most popular has been werewolf-centered fiction. For those interested, this is the Mercedes Thompson series, where our titular female protagonist is a coyote shapeshifter. She has active relationships with local werewolf packs. She ends up marrying the alpha of a local pack, and it includes other fantasy elements like the fae and vampires and even South American avatars of gods at one point. It's one of my favorite series, but in book three, the occasion of rape being visited upon our protagonist is a major component of that particular story. And it does a lot of the things that male authors so often manage to get wrong. It centers her and the fact that the rape comes from someone that she wouldn't have expected it to come from, rather than being some sort of cackling villain. It does center her as being her own savior, rather than this being an opportunity for a man to step up and rescue her from this moment, or having it be like motivation for that male character. Obviously, it does affect the ongoing story, but the focus is always on her and includes, like, it can make it more difficult to read and appreciate, because it goes in deep, and some of the deepness is like, this isn't just a thing that happens in this one book. Her trauma and PTSD and recovery from it continue on into the several books afterwards. Like, this will always be something that she has to deal with and come back from, and it treats the overall subject with respect. As opposed to Game of Thrones, which not only has way more rape than almost any other long-form series that I can think of as just being a point. Like, when I read the original Game of Thrones book, I think the first book was called Game of Thrones?
That's right, yeah. Okay. Because the book series was called a Song of Ice and Fire, but the TV show opted to have Game of Thrones be the actual, like, full show title, which, to be fair, is, I think, probably the more, like, the title that sticks in people's minds more.
Yeah, fair enough. I read the first book. I finished the first book. I quickly decided that I wasn't interested in reading anymore. And when the HBO series came out, and I found out that not only were they being quote-unquote true to the written fiction as George R. R. Martin depicted, but that on top of that, that they'd actually managed to make it worse in a lot of cases, like how these sexual scenes of violence on women are, how these scenes of violence on women are sexualized in and of themselves, that just made me go, nope, nope, I'm sorry. But it's a really good story. No, no, I'm sorry. I don't care how good any of the rest of it is. You've completely lost me. These showrunners are not someone that I want to dive into, and I'm just done. I never watched one episode of it, and I can appreciate those people that if they found something valuable in it, then that's fine. I don't want to judge the audience for it, even after it seems clear that at a certain point the series went to shit anyway because the storytellers are fucking hacks. But this was never going to be something that I was going to enjoy specifically because of their love of pushing the fucking rape button.
What it comes down to is that whenever you include this in your story, more than most other topics, it's this thing that calls attention to itself as soon as it's there, you have to know that people are going to say, why did you decide to put this in your story? Mm-hmm. And whether that will be accusatory or just a sincere question, that question is going to be asked of you with a lot more prominence than scenes of violence, scenes of anything else that are more like day-to-day sort of more common in fiction. There will be always a case of whenever you put anything in your stories, you need to ask, why am I putting this in? But that question will never be quite as sharp or quite as important as it will be with this, because one way or the other, you are going to have to confront the fact that you are likely going to lose someone because of its inclusion. No matter how carefully you go about it, I think there will be some people who, whether it's just something of their own taste or they actually can't put up with anything, it might be something that is a triggering detail to put into something that its inclusion carries a lot of significance. And I think that there's not a lot of people who necessarily acknowledge that responsibility. Mm-hmm. As much as people will often use the argument of, and this is like, it's a more palatable argument when we're talking about consensual sex and everything like that, which is, why is it that, you know, people are okay with like someone putting a dagger through someone's head, but as soon as you show a penis or a vagina, they go all up in arms? And it's like, okay, yes, on the whole, but you have to accept that no matter what you think in principle, this act here, this is the thing that leaves the worst taste in a lot of people's mouths and souls. And that's where I think that it becomes a question. That's why, for as much as, like I said at the start of this, there is terrible, awful stuff in this, this is what draws the attention. And so we talked about its presence in fiction in general, and now I think it's probably a good time to talk about how does Alex handle it in this particular story.
And that is important to address, because we've been talking about rape being used in fiction. Yeah, exactly. Rape being used in fiction in the larger sense. Having come down on this side of, like, you know, we're generally not in favor of it being a part of a story at all, and if it is, then we would be more likely to be interested in it if it is part and parcel with a female creator who we would expect to treat the subject with more respect and understanding of their responsibility and everything like that. The way Alex makes it a part of Tiger's Eye is generally palatable doesn't feel like the right word to use, because as established, the fact that it exists at all,
endurable.
Okay, I like that word. The experience of it is more endurable. We also trust Alex's intent. That's a term that's come up before, and we know enough about hearing Alex, the things that he's talked about in terms of School of Movies, in terms of talking about the creation of New Century, both on recording and just chatting online, that whenever he includes anything that is a potential sensitive subject, he goes out of his way to consult with people. Mm. I believe that with Sharon as an editor, there would have been several conversations about how to lay this out. I believe that since Maureen was going to have to voice act this moment, that there would have been moments where they had to consult and figure out if, you know, they were comfortable with how about bringing this quote unquote to life, so to speak.
Yeah, there's numerous filters to go through, to be sure.
And in terms of how it works as a part of the story, it does go out of its way to avoid a lot of the bad ways that rape is used in fiction. For one thing, the cats in general are having sexual violence predated upon them in order to bring them under control. It's not just happening to her. It just so happens that in the story's case, her rape, for some reason, and we'll get into that, takes place in front of everybody else. But it happens to both male and female captives alike. Mm-hmm. None of it is dramatized. We all just sort of, there is the implication that something bad happened, and it's the adults of us that can read through the subtext and understand it was specifically this kind of violence that was done to them. We get that. And when Miguel enters the picture, he is not framed as Hrau's savior. He knows nothing about what happened. He knows that the captors are being mistreated, very likely based on what he was seeing of when he was riding around on the captain's shoulder and seeing how they were being treated above deck. But he does not know about this level of trauma and harm being visited upon the cats of the New World, and he just wants to rescue all of them. He, in fact, does not even know for certain that Hrau is there. For some reason, he hadn't seen her above deck, and that it's certainly potentially believable. Like, they wouldn't necessarily exercise all of the captives at once, necessarily. But he has enough empathy that he wants to rescue them for their situation, even without knowing about any of the rest of this stuff.
Yeah, if Rao was not there, he wouldn't suddenly decide to turn back. He would continue the course.
Exactly. And in the meantime, the space during which these rapes occurred of the prisoners, the implication during the course of the chapters that specifically center around him suggests that he would have been in the captain's cabin this entire time. So merely the earlier treatment was enough for him to steel his courage and slowly collect the resources that he would need in order to hopefully potentially free all the captives and everything like that.
Yeah. And I think it also adds to the impression that this is not just a small ship. This really is a large craft, that at least large enough for Miguel to not immediately have a sense of who is or is not on the boat, which has the knock-on effect that when later on the cats that have realized they don't know how to control this ship, I think it sells that this is not just a small boat that has like a sort of below deck section and the top deck, and that's pretty much it. There's probably a lot of complexity to this craft that is not easy from an outsider's point of view to say, well, if we just, you know, put some oars in the water, we can turn around. No, this is quite a structure of a boat.
And finally, the other aspect to this being included in the story, and this is where the snippet from the Tiger's Eye Roundtable comes into play. One of the reasons why Alex included this was to contrast with what is essentially the lowest point of other primary characters in this story. In particular, it's meant to be part of the trifecta of symbolism of what Miguel goes through once he kills the Albion, yes, has the keys. And we'll talk more about that in a second. We need to give that its own space as well.
Which is another reason why I think it was important that Miguel not be confronted with what has been going on with this, because to be honest, at that point, it would feel like such cruelty to put even more onto this child after he has already gone through his own trauma, that I think the book never makes a judgment, and so neither will I, of which it's like, it's not a contest. They each go through something traumatic and they will handle their trauma in their own way. But to say for Miguel to go through the lowest point for him and then to be confronted with like one of the lowest points for Hrau would be so hard to put him through and so hard for us to see him be put through.
That's definitely true. But I think, as I said a moment ago, I think we're going to come back to that, because
yes,
listening to you talking about that for a second did make something else occur to me in terms of why it is certain other choices were made to not have him bear witness to these violations on the captives. The thing that I do want to talk about right now is that I've just gone into a number of explanations as to why the two of us might have accepted this being part of the story as we were originally going through it. On top of that, because of the way it's described obliquely, it's over very quickly. Like, we know it happened, and it's not belaboring on that point.
We're not lingering.
Exactly. It's not, it's very literally not being not that it's not just being dramatized, but that it's not being exploited. It happened, and Hrau now carries that weight with her, but, you know, and it's not as if, like, we're talking about an audio drama to begin with. It's not as if we could actually see the visuals. We would have to have Hrau describe it to us, which is not something that I think anyone would. Why would Alex ever ask Maury to do that? It's just that would go beyond the pale to have that happen anyway.
It would be too much for anyone. I don't think he would enjoy writing the words. I don't think that Maureen would be able. She's proved time and time again that she can do so much with this role, but it's too much to ask for a lot of people, the audience, the actors, the writer, all of it. It's just, it is better to have it in this way, I feel.
Yeah. Having said all this, now that we've unpacked both the generalities and the specifics, we are still left with a question. Did this have to be included in the story? Could this lowest moment have been portrayed by something else? The way Alex talks about it in the round table, in terms of how a child might interpret it, or rather a young person might interpret it should they read the book, is that they may not understand the idea of sexual violence yet, and may just assume that whatever happened to Hrau was her being beaten severely. And of course, as savvy readers that can read between the lines, we know that that can't have been it, because they were deliberately trying to find a way to get the Aboriginal cats to submit that didn't result in damage that would lower their asking value, especially if it was happening on a seemingly widespread scale, as was implied by the number of times that the sailors went back to pick someone else to be a representative of quelling rebellion and making them docile, as the words being used there. It's still, there could have been other ways to potentially make this possible. Like, if the captivity and seeing some of their number killed and thrown overboard wasn't enough, another consideration we have to take into account is that the inclusion of the rape isn't just about how it affects Hrau or the audience. It also leads to the confrontation between Captain Queensberry and Mohawk, and puts a spotlight on how she really feels about having this awful cat on her crew. It's a way to make us, the audience, realize that, or rather to further hone in on the fact that just because Beatrix is a villain, it doesn't mean that she herself doesn't have limits, and that she employs Mohawk because he quote-unquote gets results, but she's not necessarily happy with ends justifying means. Like, maybe they do on a, you know, dealing with the stock level, but it's clear that she has personal opinions about it.
And
Lorena does an incredible job of making that very
conveying cool. That.
Yeah, exactly. It may be less obvious in the written version of Tiger's Eye, but in the audio drama, just the way she's talking through gritted teeth, or the quality of tonality that she uses when she does those lines, it's just all so very icy.
2 or 3 days from now, they'll have fixed who's in control. And they'll be as docile and compliant as kittens. Strongest way to make the point without killing any more of them than we have to. And, as a little cherry on top, it keeps the boys happy.
So it does.
And that's what you want right about now. A lot of them are getting skittish about these waters. They know about the Pride of Cortez sinking right around this point. They're superstitious. They think they've seen the widow under the waves already.
I've never seen her once. Not so much as an oversized fin. And this is my 6th passage across this lane.
I don't believe in her either. But they do. It's my job to keep their minds on their work. And warming their bellies against those primitive heathens is the quickest and best possible way to do this.
Playing chess isn't working for them, then?
Why, you don't like my methods?
How could I like them?
Well, luckily I don't need you to like them. Just give me the okay.
Keep them in place.
I'll keep them in place.
On a meta level, I think that it's also a question of drawing a line, not just for the different lions involved in the slave trade, but kind of for New Century as a whole, in a sense of there are hard things that these stories will put you through. And this is kind of like the hardest in some ways, just this. On the back of hearing the details of this slave trade, on the back of hearing about Miguel's, like, his abusive father, and on the back of hearing about Frau losing her daughter, this is kind of like peak, not peak, it really is the bottom that we have reached in terms of the hardest thing to put the audience through.
Yeah, I was about to say, lowest point for Hurrah, but also lowest point for the audience as well.
Yeah. It feels like after this, and certain developments that we'll get into, there is a firm line that is being drawn that we can't promise that either as people recommending the series or like just people who know Alex and his style of writing and where his interests lie, we can't promise that this is the very last time that this subject matter will ever be brought up or referenced or anything like that. But I think that this is a gesture on his part that this is not something that will be common. It will be treated as something that is heavy, is not dwelled on, and is not repeated. It's not that this goes on for many chapters, that this is an ongoing circumstance of the capture. This is isolated to one sequence where this is discussed. Mm. And then we get to discussion of how to get out of this or what they can do to change their circumstances. it's something that is, and I'm not sure that I can isolate what in the text itself is kind of making that gesture to us, but it feels like between the different books that this does stand out, and the fact that it stands out, and the fact that in a few chapters' time, Mohawk is just, you know, told very definitively, just go, is a firm statement that this is not going to be common, that this will not be something that lingers in the story. Whereas in Game of Thrones, rapists, characters who are rapists, just cling to the series for season after season after season, and then they'll get torn apart by wolves, or they'll be pushed out of a staircase or something, but like after they've been Frankenstein. It's just all like, it's stuff that feels like we just, it's a place that we don't want to be in because it stagnates. Mm-hmm. Here it's like we have this brush against the very worst, and then we can come out of it. I've been circling around the notes that I prepared for this, but I think I'm ready to say it, is that to say that Frau's rape is especially upsetting feels crass and inconsiderate, as if rape in fiction is ever anything other than deeply upsetting. So instead I will say that this one element of the story that adds to the pain of this development is that so much of Tiger's Eye is about being enveloped in this world, immersing yourself in the sensory details that the language includes and makes use of to make you feel as if you're being relayed this journey beat by beat, experiencing each moment as Harau experiences it. So Harau's rape becomes a violation of that sensory experience, which makes it all the more appalling. Unlike the general writing philosophy of the rest of the book up to this point, it is elected that the moment doesn't focus on the details and being present in each thing as it happens. So much of the book is talking about what the moment is like, whereas this is where, in this scene, Harau and the author decides to step away from the moment. It distinguishes it from the rest of the narrative without enhancing its presence any more than is absolutely required. The parts of Tiger's Eye that the story focuses on and we tend to remember and value are the feelings of freedom and the vibrancy of this other world and the uplifting connections between people who were previously disconnected and have every reason to be at odds with one another. Harau's rape is the antithesis of that, framing it as the darkest point of opposition against all that is valued and celebrated within this narrative.
Yeah. I did have other things here in my notes, and maybe I'll salvage some of them for when I get into the edit. I don't know that I really want to talk about this anymore. It's not like I want to ever be throwing stones at anyone. Obviously, the fact that we're doing a podcast on this series means that for any moments in there that we have issues with, we love the overall more than enough that it's not a deal breaker for us. We can't speak for others that it may be a deal breaker for. It brings to mind in particular my instinct to want to have a black man or woman guest on the podcast back when we were discussing secret rooms. To be honest, I did not try as hard as I could have to find a guest, because I wanted to draw only from a pool of people that were already fans of New Century. I want to make sure to talk as honestly as we could about these subjects. But because Toby and I are privileged white men, that means there are topics I wouldn't want us to be the last word on. But if I brought in a person of color to talk about race, or a woman to talk about rape in media, and they weren't already secure in their appreciation for New Century, then I would run the risk of causing potential harm, because their opinions might be harsher than ours. See, I know that we have a small audience of fans. But I also know that includes the people responsible for making New Century come alive. School of Movies is aimed at the audience for movies. It is not made to speak to creators of said movies, whether the opinions are good, bad, or indifferent. But we have interacted with Alex and Sharon and most of the cast by now, and that means we are understandably biased. Sharing opinions that are critical of the work is legitimate. But we can be diplomatic and empathetic about it. This is, after all, a fan podcast, not a review show. And what that means is that, honestly, we wouldn't want to bring anyone on if we think they may have a profoundly negative reaction to the source material, for whatever reason. And this is coming from someone that is triggered by rape in media. I don't remember if I told you about this, but it's something that's come up on Discord a couple of times. I had very much been getting into and enjoying the British series Downton Abbey. And partway into, I want to say, either season... I guess it would be series, because it's a BBC show. But series 4 or series 5... a rape subplot was introduced into the story, and it came out of nowhere. And the experience of watching it play out during that episode, and of course having to then be dealt with over the next several episodes and even into the next season, even just that first experience, that was enough for me to like, okay, I can't watch this right now. And I considered to myself, am I even going to be able to come back to this? Because I knew the show creator, and I think the guy that was doing most of the writing was a male voice, and so therefore did not necessarily trust their intent at handling it well. And honestly, although I did eventually come back to it and finish out the series because my mother wanted to watch the Downton Abbey movie, I don't think it was handled particularly well. I don't think it was handled egregiously, but I don't think it was handled well.
That's also an issue, is that the inclusion of rape in fiction sort of demands that you don't just turn in acceptable or mediocre work, because it feels like if you were only going to do a passable job at it, this is such a strong flavor. Why did you do this unless you had something very specific that you had thought out and had faith in, that this was, like, there was a genuine thought to be expressed and conveyed here?
Yeah. My point is that I have a more sensitive than some button being pressed here whenever that particular subject is brought up. But my experience with Tiger's Eye is that it happened, and I needed to take a break from it at that moment before proceeding on, but I never felt like this was a plot twist that I couldn't come back from. I wanted to know what happened next, because at that point I was invested. I trusted Alex's intent, and by and large, he did not disappoint.
Yes, and it didn't feel like a betrayal of your trust.
No. I don't think that that would necessarily happen, not when it feels like Alex has been so very honest with his motivations and his desires and his feelings as being a component of not only this work, but many other of his creative works. But, you know, it does make me think about some of the things he said about the upcoming Stone Spring Maidens, that he suspects that it might be divisive in terms of how people respond to it. And certainly, as we have discussed in the Uncivil Outlaw Q&A, and we'll come back to eventually when we do the in-depth review of the book, there were elements of Uncivil Outlaw which included a certain level of divisiveness, or at the very least were difficult for the audience to get behind. But so far, none of this has been a deal breaker for me. I still am secure, as to use a term that Alex introduced me to, I am secure in my love for New Century, and it would take a lot to get in the way of that.
Yes. I think it's important. The last thing I will bring up before we do move on is that we've talked a lot about how our personal connection to Alex and his work, not just in New Century, but with School of Movies and his discussion and behind the scenes, means that we have a level of trust in his intent. But it's also important to consider how the works do function in and of themselves. And even from that perspective, if someone was approaching this and knew nothing about who this Alexander Shaw, who he was or what kind of personality he was, I think that the structure of the book helps with this, because it would be a lot if this scene happened earlier in the book. Like if it was in the first five chapters, I think that's another pitfall that can happen, is that because it's this very dramatic event, a lot of writers decide to bake that into the sort of background of characters, which means you're confronting them with this very strong flavor early on in your story when you haven't necessarily built up that trust yet. But Tiger's Eye has kind of already done the best part of a journey with Miguel and Harao and has got you invested. It's done this whole arc where you didn't know what the deal with Harao was, and now you know what her deal was before it introduces this concept to you. In some ways, I could totally see the argument or the possibility for someone experiencing it as, we were going in one direction and then this came in and that felt like I couldn't go on after that. But I would argue that it really, I think, is a good move to not put this earlier on, because it does provide you with enough work beforehand so that you can judge for yourself the intent of the writing, even if you don't know the author behind it.
Yeah. I gotta stop talking about this.
Yes. Okay. I'm just desperately scrolling down the notes and seeing what a like funny moment might be. Why are we talking about the slave trade chapters?
Yeah. No. Okay. Let's just move on directly to the moment after the rape, which I ended up writing a little bit of a thing about, in terms of finding it absolutely appropriate that it was Harao's idea to form a unity among the disparate captives where the others hadn't thought to work on that from before. It's because communication and trying to communicate with those that you don't share a common language with has been a central focus of the story up till that point. The Silent One helped put tools in her toolbox, and therefore practicing with the shaman, and then practicing with Miguel. And not only does she put into practice what she has learned, she also uses every connection she has made in the process, in order to reach out to everyone whose lives she has touched. She doesn't have all the language tools, but she understands through experience that others might and do, and therefore is setting people in motion so that they are all working towards this common goal. Most importantly, the novel shows us that she isn't specifically able to pull this off because she is the protagonist. She pulls it off because learning how to communicate has been core to her journey, and I especially appreciate that.
Communication is the magic gift that the Silent One gives her. We talked earlier about the hero's journey and how this book does follow that, and it's because the power that she obtains is just being reminded, try talking with people. And it's in contrast to how we see her at the beginning, where she isn't like completely blocking people out, but when people try to engage with her, she doesn't sort of put a paw in their face to say, I'm walking away from this conversation, but you can tell that she is kind of deftly rolling off from it and just moving away. And it's not heavy and hard stuff all at once, it's just baby steps. And this is kind of the biggest challenge is for her to establish and seek out these connections and to share that. Cats coming together and reaching out to one another, culminating in them creating a bond that goes profoundly deep. That's so necessary here because it picks you up after this moment of despair that we have gone into such detail on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's necessary because if the story stayed with just Hrau and it didn't involve anyone else, it could feel like the horrifying event would be echoing in the story. It would just be lingering. Instead, because Mohawk actually took on this sort of second phase of his plan to break the captive cats, this shows that that categorically did not work. His plan failed. They have unified. They've become more connected than ever. And it's the kind of uplifting hope that you need right now in the story.
Well, see, that's actually what you just said there a moment ago, is that it may not be that what Mohawk was doing failed necessarily, like it wasn't working, but because Hrau stands up and becomes a beacon, becomes a focal point for hope, and makes the cats actually feel like, hey, maybe there's a way out of this other than death. Or yeah. even if death is, death could be considered preferable to living in captivity, whatever it is. Obviously, the quote that most people might be thinking of right now is one of the last words of Eric Killmonger. Bury me in the ocean with my ancestors who jumped from ships because they knew death was better than bondage. But the moment that I want to share most with you is a clip from American Gods, where Anansi, as played by Orlando Jones, is speaking to a bunch of slaves on board a ship much like this one. I'm not going to play the entire clip for those who have not seen it, because it's 4 minutes long. But Anansi is basically laying out the next several hundred years of how those black people and all future generations of black people in America get screwed over by white people. He encourages them to go up on deck and try to kill the slavers. One of them responds in his native language, "But the ship will burn. All of us will die." And Anansi's response?
You already dead, asshole. At least die a sacrifice for something worthwhile. Let the motherfucker burn. Let it all burn.
He frees the slaves. They revolt and set fire to the ship. It's unlikely that any survived. But then, they didn't have the resources that our heroes have. This tale of Anansi is one of understandable righteous anger, but it's not what our story is about, because we need more than anger. Tiger's Eye and all of New Century is centered on one central premise. Hope. She is the rallying cry that does bring hope back to these people, and somehow she still manages to be that spark even after being brutally taken in front of all of them and having them see her humiliation. It doesn't make them think less of her, so that's actually a good thing overall. It perhaps makes them more sympathetic. I don't know. It's complicated.
It is, and I think that you're right. It's not that, what I said is not to necessarily suggest that what Mohawk did had no effect. Of course it has an effect. But I think it is significant that that act is being taken to try and snuff out the fire in them. And it does make their embers nearly go out. But they take this action to reignite that spark among them. And I think that's what feels significant, is that it feels like all hope is lost. And what is that? Speaking of quotes, Uncle Iroh in Last Airbender.
In the darkest times, hope is something you give yourself. That is the meaning of inner strength.
This is, I think, why just us talking about, you know, some of our favorite fiction and films, books, series that all mean something to us, and why we include Tiger's Eye in this, even after talking about a scene that could be a deal breaker for some, is that it, that message is, as much as we can cite all these examples, it's so important that we keep telling this to ourselves, because there are so many things that will try and make that hope, you know, flicker and ebb out. And it is something that we give ourselves, and focal points like Hrau in this story, or just these stories in general to us, are the things that help us just reignite that fire.
Yeah. You you mentioned a moment ago about trying to look down the list of questions and trying to find something that is more humorous that we can play off of. Honestly, this is what is reigniting our fire as well, because there really isn't a whole lot of humor at all over the course of these chapters in the story. It's the lowest point in general for the characters, even when they have successes and manage to fight back against their captors, yet in order to survive, they have to re-enter some form of captivity. And at the end of this final chapter that we discussed today, it seems like we have reached another all is lost moment here before the end finally culminates. But even for all of the darkness and all of the difficulty, it doesn't stop any of this from being engaging or exciting. You know, even darker stuff can be supremely compelling. So we should move on to talk about some of those moments. But for today, we will leave it there. There's still around 2 to 2.5 hours of content left for these chapters, which means at least 2 more episodes left to discuss all the topics we have lined up. It's not the last time that the subject of Hrau's rape will come up, but we've gotten the heavy stuff out of the way. As I recall, we even eventually come to terms with it thematically, as I later have a sudden insight into how Hrau takes back agency for herself, not through violence, but through vulnerability. This is going to be the first episode of the new year, as I am up late at 4 a.m. January 1st, editing this podcast. To close us out, once more I'm getting away from the world music and bringing it back to the music of my youth, the Indigo Girls. This particular song is emblematic of their sound, the lyrics acknowledging the darkness of night, but assuring that you are up to the challenge. We are all chosen ones if we choose ourselves. It's 2021, and we have just begun. Until next time, this is Secure Yourself.
Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. In the ink of the night I saw you bleed, through the thunder I could hear you scream. Solitude, the air I breathe, open eyed and fast asleep. Falling softly as the rain, no footsteps ringing in your ears. Ragged down onto the skin, for your raging have no fear. Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. broken prayers, hearts and bones from days of youth. Restless with an angel's wing, I dig a grave to bury you. No feet to fall, you need no ground, allowed to glide right through the sun. Released from circles guarded tight, now we all are chosen ones. Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. Hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. Beneath the night I saw you bleed, the thunder I could hear you scream. Solitude, the air I breathe, open eye, fast asleep, all softly as the rain. No footsteps ringing in your ears, drag it down onto the skin. For your raging, have no fear, secure yourself to heaven. Hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. Seven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. Secure yourself to heaven, hold on tight, the night has come. Fasten up your earthly burdens, you have just begun. Secure yourself, our chosen ones, allow the night has come. Guarded tight, now we all are chosen ones.